are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, August 29th, 2016. My name is Michael Brooks on a Michael Monday. And this is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Rafia Zakaria, Pakistani author, journalist, commentator, discussing whether or not feminism, war reporting, can be a feminist project. We'll get into that. We'll talk about the colonial dimensions of gender, war reporting, and a lot more. Also, is spring in the air in Zimbabwe? ZANU-PF contemplates state of emergency as protests erupt across Harare, protesting the decades-long rule of Robert Mugabe and ZANU-PF. Dilma Rousseff vigorously defends herself, facing impeachment, vigorously defends herself in the Brazilian Senate, talks about getting elected democratically, her record fighting poverty. Hillary Clinton drew the connection between Donald Trump and this alt-right thing. She also may have given a great boost to Alex Jones's career, unfortunately. Sleazy, 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 sleazy pharma company jacking up prices. But is it a feature or a bug of capitalism? The Colombian government and the FARC rebels have signed a ceasefire, ending a decades-long brutal guerrilla war in that country. That ceasefire has formally gone into effect. And Donald Trump, I don't even know how to process this one, and that's saying a lot for me and Donald Trump. But there was a horrible murder of a famous basketball player's cousin. And what was his first reaction? She got killed in front of her kid. Black people are going to vote for me. It's true. It's really true. Even I am ready for this election to be over. It's true. It's really true. And we will hear from Maine Governor Paula Podge, who is at least a self-made Donald Trump, but a prototype. He left a good voicemail for state legislator in Maine, where he explained how he felt about being called a racist. And he wanted the guy to prove it, and then went on to go prove it himself. And talked to San Francisco's 49 player, Colin Kaepernick, on why he's sitting out during the national anthem.
Kaepernick.
Ugh. Kaepernick. And showing that he's on top of his brief. He's a smart dude. As radicalism potentially returns to professional sports. We're back from vacation, and I want to check in with everybody. But first, I want to let everybody know about one of today's sponsors. I spent a lot of this vacation. I basically like to go swimming and hiking, see family, see some old friends, and just read. I like to actually catch up on my reading. And I love this sponsor we have today, Texture. So look, Texture is completely reimagined magazines. It gives you the articles and stories you really want all in one place, plus interactive features, videos, and recommendations just for you. So yeah, it's curated, and they can find your unique patterns. Maybe you're like Sam, where he reads The New Yorker and Handyman magazine. That's an interesting reading set. If you're like me, you can read, you know, Esquire, magazines about sports and tennis, and also The New Yorker, Rolling Stone. Texture app lets you tap in the world's most popular magazines anytime, anywhere, using your smartphone or tablet. Breeze through hundreds of your favorite magazines, including back issues, and pick the articles that interest you most. Texture has made it easy to find the articles you care about. You don't just have to read, you know, the full magazine, the full title. The Texture editorial team recommends content for you every day. Plus, I can dive deeper with personalized collections. So that's my sort of own Michael Brooks magazine at my fingertips, or Sam Cedar magazine, or Kelly Carey magazine, or Matt Leck magazine. Nat actually reads, and then he dictates the article to himself, and then he listens to it at a sped-up speed. It's interesting. The best part of Texture, and if you sign up for Texture right now, you get insider access to all of the contents from the world's best publications. And I'm not kidding. I mean, this is just, let me just give you some of the examples here. You got Adweek, that's relevant for two dope boys. You have Canadian Health and Lifestyle. That's specific and actually kind of awesome if you're interested in that. You have Dwell, which is an amazing building and architecture and design magazine. As I said, Rolling Stone, Mother Jones. You have PC World, Men's Health. I mean, Motor Trend, Motorcyclist, the Smithsonian, the National Geographic, New York Magazine.
I subscribed to Motor Trend in high school.
You subscribed to Motor Trend in high school?
Rewatch it. Read it, I guess.
Re-listen to it. And Macworld, Maclean's. I mean, just an overabundance of great resources here. And the best part is Texture is offering Majority Report listeners a free trial right now when you go to texture.com/majority. You'll gain entry to all of the top magazines, including back issues and bonus video content. Start binge reading for free right now when you go to texture.com/majority. Link is on our website. We have one more sponsor to get to, but really quickly, how was everybody's break?
Mine was good. I actually watched a movie, which I haven't done in months. I watched Inside Llewyn Davis. It was enjoyable. It's maybe not the most amazing or notable Coen Brothers movie, but it's a solid Coen Brothers movie.
Matt Leck consumed a solid Coen Brothers movie on his vacation. Kelly Carey, what did you do?
I went to the beach. I had an extended vacation.
Did you take your dog to the beach?
No, it wasn't allowed.
Oh, no.
I know. It was such a bummer. Garbage. But I boarded her for the first time, and she seemed to really like it. At least they said so. And
they have a little bit of a self-interest to say that.
Well, yeah, but she seemed happy.
She seemed happy.
She
okay.
likes being around other dogs. And right. then I stuck around Brooklyn for the second week, and I consumed The Night Of, the HBO series. And even though it's a remake and I kind of knew what was going to happen, it was a little different. It was good. So,
I got to get on Night Of.
I liked it.
My friend Waz was texting me about that the other day.
It's long. I mean, it's only 8 parts long, but it's a commitment if you don't watch a lot of TV.
It is so weird having that monitor there. It's like I see like your hand gestures.
I can see you. That's
so funny. That's, and you can see me on the camera. It's so funny.
Yeah.
All right. Let me get to this other sponsor before we get to Rafia. Not all ingredients are created equal. Fresh, high-quality ingredients taste better, and they're better for you. So it's important to know where your food comes from. That's why I love Blue Apron. I've had the opportunity to cook with Blue Apron. Had meals that are like, you know, hearty kind of American style meals, meals that are more like kind of more Asian style, which I tend to really like a lot. It tastes incredible. They're very, very easy to make. And it's actually fun. It's a fun activity to do with someone else. Blue Apron has established partnerships with over 150 local farms, fisheries, and ranchers across the United States. As a result, seafood is sourced sustainably under its standards developed in partnership with the Monterey Bay Aquarium Seafood Watch. Beef is raised humanely. Regenerative farming practices are used for produce. And Blue Apron can be delivered to 99% of the continental U.S. and 99.5% of all food deserts. And because Blue Apron ships the exact amount of each ingredient required for a recipe, they are reducing food waste. Cooking together builds strong bonds. Research shows that Blue Apron families cook nearly 3 times more often. And those who spend a lot to eat out at high-end grocery chains can now spend under $10 per person on a delicious meal. That's an incredible price point if you're in that realm of eating a little bit more why have better tasting meals, really? Blue Apron knows that when you cook with incredible ingredients, you make incredible meals. So they set the highest quality standards for the community of artisanal suppliers, family-run farms, fisheries, and ranchers. Blue Apron delivers seasonal recipes along with pre-portioned ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals, whether it's Japanese ramen noodles with wild-caught salmon or heirloom tomatoes. Blue Apron is bringing you the best. Here's some of the meals available on this. Spiced pork burgers with goat cheese and cucumber corn salad. That is so good that even Matt might condescend from his desires for some type of like AI intelligence nutrient ingestion machine that he wants to subsist on to actually eat that. It sounds incredible. Right, Matt?
It does, yeah.
Summer vegetables and quinoa bowl with fairy tale eggplants, shishito peppers and corn, chicken tinga tacos with summer squash and tomato salsa. Excuse me. I want to leave and eat while I read this. Check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/majority. You'll love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron, so don't wait. That's blueapron.com/majority. blueapron.com/majority. There is a link on the Majority Report homepage. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. We will be right back with Rafia Zakaria.
Lip up them and lip up. I'm missing enough of them a flip up. All of them a free run when King Selassie broke his seven seal and get up. Easy. Look how my jet. Terrible. Wall all your head. Government run under bed. When you see the Rasta coming, him a coming with the links and chalice with the chalice and roots. Holding firm to my tradition like a magician. We make the chains from the Vatican poof. Break loose from the minds of the African youth. Even though it may seem like magic, all we do is liberate minds, separate folly from truth. Next time you buy a ticket for Sikranics. From me say ease up. Everybody start moving. It means so much more than a Grammy. For see the youth, them arise. Spiritually that prove humanity arise literally. Ascend to dimensions where God is just you. Chalice and roots. Chronics in my verse right here. This is a blessing and a curse right here. Blessing to the people with the birthright. But to them dirty capitalists, it's a them worst nightmare. Them a lip up. Them get flip up like a pancake and all them treddy figure trim up like my landscape. Big up to my listeners, me do this for the fans sake. The ones when liberal oppose the lyrics could I translate. Pass for your blast. New vape and the only floss, me a floss. Roots and chalice, our pass, we a pass. While some a pass out on the grass, we a laugh. Nah, change the topic. Chronics of a song already about that, so me stop it. The way out of poverty, the artists are plotted. So go tell Lisa and I did your job and stop me.
Welcome back to the Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks. Joining us now is Rafia Zakaria. She is a writer and columnist whose work has appeared in The Nation, The Guardian, and she is a columnist for the Dawn newspaper in Pakistan. Rafia, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing really well. I'm post-vacation and realizing that I would like more vacation.
Oh, but yikes, because I'm talking to you on the Monday post-vacation.
Yeah.
That's a challenging day.
I save you for special occasions when I'm like, I need to, I'm off like crying because I'm no longer lapping a lake. So I'll talk to Rafia about all of the misdeeds of the Western world. So Rafia, you have a piece. I want to get to this piece in The Nation that you have that came out on August 24th. There's a lot of themes in this, and it's called Can War Reporting Be a Feminist Project? Now, there's two sort of images from pop culture that kind of snapped out, jumped out to me when I first saw this piece, even before I read it. And one was, you know, a while ago, Katy Perry had this music video. I don't remember for which song. It's my mistake. But essentially, it was like, you know, some guy breaks up with her in a, you know, a bad way, and then she joins the army and becomes like this Marine and is ready to, like, you know, kind of like a killing machine. Almost like the way to get over Russell Brand breaking up with you is to go like kill Afghans as the sort of like ultimate self-esteem sort of rebuilding. we have a new, you know, this Tina Fey movie where she kind of, you know, it's sort of like the madcap version of that, where she goes to Afghanistan and play and as a war reporter. So there's this interesting kind of cultural space of like the war zone as like a place of like American self-discovery almost.
Yes, I mean, you're right. I think one of the corollaries of being at war for now over a decade, almost 15 years, and at war with the, you know, Afghanistan, Iraq, and the larger Middle East, has been that war is also now in a very, that particular war especially, is, you know, parsed through the mechanisms of popular culture, whether it's Katy Perry videos, whether it's books by journalists, whether it's fiction. And that, of course, is inevitable because, mm-hmm. you know, it occupies, what occupies a place in our politics is inevitably going to be filtered through popular culture. I think the more problematic iteration of that has been that, you know, while we're the left particularly, but, you know, Americans in general might inflect some seriousness when they're talking about war based on, say, you know, a news story or an article in the paper or a policy direction. These iterations of war in popular culture generally receive less scrutiny, you know, but they are nevertheless still very, very important in constructing, you know, either tangibly or intangibly, our ideas of who the enemy is, who the other is, and what sorts of ways we can, you know, and how we look at ourselves, because that's essentially a relational act. You know, I mean, we define ourselves by what we think other people are. And the moral burden, of course, you know, of wars and of the fact that the U.S. has imposed huge amounts of casualties and sort of infrastructural damage on these countries, perhaps, you know, the moral weight of that is too much. And so you have kind of transformations of that in popular culture. So like, you know, Whiskey Tango Foxtrot with Tina Fey, which is based on Kim Barker's book, is a great example of that because it tries to make light of what is actually a very, very horrific situation. And it does so, it's not just that it cracks jokes at the expense of people who generally cannot talk back or provide any level of critical scrutiny to how they are being depicted within that formulation. And I think that last aspect, the fact that we're willing to make fun of or sort of advocate the extermination of people, you know, in popular culture, and that we don't really pause to consider the moral implications of that is what is problematic, I think, for me.
Mm-hmm. So let's get down to the specifics of the books you're talking about. And it seems like I always like making these distinctions with you and in general, but because I think they're very important, that, again, there's sort of, in this landscape, there's the colonial history, the colonial dimensions of American foreign policy. There's the civilian casualties. There's, you know, our just sort of global social engineering. Then there's, you know, legitimate and I think, you know, real threats. They may be exaggerated. They might be very misunderstood, but there is terrorism. There are human rights abuses. Those are real things. And then there's this really problematic territory, which you explore a lot, of human rights, because it's not a question of minimizing some of these issues, but it's definitely the way that they are just sort of constantly deployed in the service of either sort of I guess very practically really wrong and disastrous in many cases policies, but then also to just sort of reinforce narratives that let us off the hook, as you were saying before, kind of defining ourselves in relation. And specifically, you focus on this notion of war reporting as a feminist project because you talk about access to women's spaces in pretty patriarchal places like Pakistan, as an example, or Afghanistan, that can be accessed by women reporters from the West. But then that process of sort of trust and opening is not necessarily reciprocated in the reporting.
Yeah, I mean, the nation piece takes this on. And, you know, at the outset, I have to say, because I do sometimes see these sorts of critiques that I write reduced to, well, you think white women just shouldn't go out there and tell these stories. That's actually not what I'm saying at all. What I am trying to point out is how, you know, we have these sorts of different strains of empowerment in our mm-hmm. culture, in American culture. And then you have different strains of, and in a sense, those strains of empowerment often define what is universally considered feminist, right? So mm-hmm. a journalist, a female journalist particularly, who's going into a war zone to report is considered brave, and that's considered, a step ahead for women. And I'm not contesting that. I'm not contesting the fact that it is very brave, no matter what color you are, to go and try to tell these stories at the risk of personal danger to yourself. The part that I found problematic is what I would call like this kind of sleight of hand, where the reporting is being sold or presented within this framework of look at this brave woman, female reporter. And the consequence of that framework is that it is the female reporter who's going into these intimate spaces that becomes the story. So all the time you're aware of the fact that this story has come to you via this female reporter who is white and who has put herself in grave danger. So there's this juxtaposition then between the Afghan woman sitting in a shelter or can't leave her house or, you know, just every kind of trope of submission and subjugation. That is real. I'm not denying that either. But what it does is put things within that context. So brave white woman journalist and versus subjugated, faceless, Afghan woman. And that, I think, is a problematic juxtaposition because it doesn't present it claims to, but doesn't actually present any particular truths about the lives of those women, first of all. Second of all, it kind of fudges what I call these two warring feminisms, which is, you know, on one hand, you have the feminism of a shared sisterhood, empathy and understanding the issues and problems of other women. And then there is another feminism, the lean-in sort of feminism of career advancement. Mm-hmm. And in that story of a white female journalist going into Afghanistan, for example, those two concepts are fudged. So when they're trying to get the access, it's very much a feminism of sisterhood, right? Because I'm a woman, I'm going to go in this space and I'm going to get this story. And
Rafia, could you just pause one moment and just spell out when we talk about going into these spaces that are sort of restrict or, you know, more zones of femininity in a place like Afghanistan. Can we, I want you to finish your point, but can you specify what those zones are and what that kind of entails practically and on the ground?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I start the article with this, and I think your listeners and readers will be familiar. I mean, in much of the Middle East, in Afghanistan, and to a certain extent also in, you know, in Pakistan and other Muslim countries. Pakistan, I would say, is only a partially gender segregated society, but, you know, in general, women's spaces are separate. I grew up in a house. I mean, this doesn't mean that women never see men or that, you know, they're sort of imprisoned in these spaces. What it simply means is that, you know, there are spaces probably within any home in those regions where women, this, you sit around with sisters and aunts and cousins, and there is a greater degree of intimacy and a kind of letting down, you know, letting your guard down, mm-hmm. because you're just around other women. And being in those female spaces is, you know, there are a set of sort of expectations and understanding that go with those spaces. So they might not always be explicit, but if you've spent time in any of these cultures, they are, you know, you would understand right. that these are spaces where, you know, there's a certain expectation or understanding of closeness, and, you know, it's not a professional environment as such. It's a place where you're relaxing, and so you're not going to be particularly maybe self-conscious or conscious about every word
right.
you say.
Right, and then the notion would be that this is a place where obviously you can potentially access a different, you know, disclosure about how a place operates. So back to the larger point you were making, which was that when there's this sort of dual track of a kind of careerism versus solidarity, if I could shorthand it, if that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
And then that you can kind of use the solidarity to maybe get access to a place that, as an example, just practically a male journalist sort of can't. They're not going to be invited to kind of like hang out and have tea in one of those rooms for a variety of reasons. So there can be this sort of, okay, I want to hear your narrative. I want to hear your perspective. I want you to embody the situation in your own particular way. But then, I mean, are you saying that, I mean, practically as a career level, that might be one of the most sort of few advantages, and you pointed this out, and it's been pointed out by others, that women journalists have, which is like, well, I can actually sort of access this situation that maybe my male counterparts can't in a place like Afghanistan. And then the third part is how it's filtered back to a Western audience, which you say in this piece and reviewing some of these authors, which you can, you know, get to, that it isn't the upshot is not necessarily political, social solidarity and exposure. It's kind of like a certain maybe voyeurism that again reasserts the kind of personal qualities of the Western reporter doing the reporting.
Absolutely. I think, you know, the point that I'm making is that while they may use this sort of implicit understanding of sisterhood to get in and get the story, it is still a very Western, white, and I would even argue male framing that the story comes out in. So, for instance, the example, and I think that there's this sort of feminist empowerment motif that goes in getting the story.
Mm-hmm.
But the part that I'm upset about is that, okay, so, you know, for instance, if you're a Times photographer and you go in and you get this story, I don't think that there's a lot of questioning among these journalists on whether the story they're telling is a story that essentially still fits into the same exotic orient, mm-hmm. submissive Muslim woman paradigm, which I would argue is actually a very patriarchal paradigm that they themselves have fought against, you know, in the West as part of the feminist movement. And so I'll give you, you know, one of the examples, for instance, I talk about in the article is you know, one journalist, and she's going out and she's very much looking to break into the New York Times and play some pieces there. Mm-hmm. And she goes and interviews this mother and daughter that operate, and this is before the Syria, I mean, you know, before Syria was at war. She goes to Syria and she interviews these women that run a female-only madrasa or religious school. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she kind of finds out what they're all about and she gets all this material. But, you know, it's in a sense not very sexy because there's no sort of, I mean, it's just women running this religious school. So she puts the quote and the story about this woman and her mother and their religious school with a parallel narrative about the Qubaysiyat or a secret Quranic sisterhood that she has also heard about in Syria. She has nothing other than her hunch, you know, to there's really nothing connecting those two. Mm-hmm. But she puts both of them next to each other in that story because, you know, a secret sisterhood is sexier than just, you know, women running a religious school. And then what happens is that after the story is published, she speaks to the daughter. Mm-hmm. And the daughter is, you know, there's a tension there because, you know, this association is problematic. And then the journalist admits herself that putting those two things together may actually endanger both the religious school and the women that she interviewed over there. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, the Syrian secret police, you know, thinks, okay, that they really might be associated with this secret sisterhood. So that's an illustrative case, right? Because you use this kind of sisterhood, this kind of I really care about your story. But then when you're selling your story, and it is true that women still face, even in the West, a largely white, you know, male editorial, you know, leadership.
Right.
There isn't any pushback at that end to say, you know, I want you to just publish this story and not, you know, and I'm not going to sort of tinker with it and make it what people,
or
you know,
sex
have
it
read
up.
Over,
I mean, to use that old, like, Iraq thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, and that's actually literal because none of the stories the same journalist wrote is, you know, about the most promiscuous virgins in the world.
Yes.
And then that's a story about, you know, Lebanese women. So, yes.
And an amazing quote from that article, though, that you pulled is that one of, and that's sort of like, and again, I think that's, at least in that case, it isn't, I guess, a speculative, but she's exploring the kind of marriage market and those dynamics in Lebanon, which is a, you know, legitimate thing to write about, explore. But one of the young women that she's speaking to says to her at one point, like, why are you so worried about us? Why don't you go talk to, like, I forget the phrase, like the serious woman or something, like the woman that are, she used some phrase like that, who are working on education, employment, human rights. Like, we're just trying to kind of, like, you know, do our nails and get married, and that's, like, fine. That's our thing. But why are you so interested in that? There's a lot more kind of activity taking place in Lebanon than we're involved with. I mean, it was kind of fascinating.
Yes. I mean, I think, you know, when I read that, I got goosebumps.
Yeah.
Because it just shows, I mean, look, it is a reality that there are vast, and this is not something exclusive just to, you know, white women writing about Muslim women. But there often is a very, and you as a journalist know this, a power differential between the person who is going to tell the story and the subjects of the story.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that is not something that can be wished away. And that is also actually a reason why telling stories is important, because of that huge gap in power. But it becomes a separate issue when we're not willing to look at how we can mediate that difference in a way that is not just ethical, but also, you know, that also reflects these other concerns. So, I mean, you know, the trick here is that, okay, I mean, journalism involves trying to get the story, and often a lot of journalists sort of feign some kind of, quote, friendship with people to mm-hmm. try to understand what they're all about, and that's not at all exclusive to this context. But there's a difference between, you know, the story that you would get in that, you know, in within that dynamic, and sort of understanding that in these cases, the story is sold as a, you know, as a kind of example of feminist achievement.
Right.
So when Alyssa Rubin or any of the other women, and Lindsay Addario, talk about going into these environments, they're very much considered sort of heroines in Western feminism because they're doing that. So, you know, you can't have that both ways. You can't sort of use, you know, this I'm your buddy and I'll get the, you know, do that. And then say, okay, well, I'm a journalist, so I don't have allegiance with anybody. So I'm just going to tell this story however I want to tell it, because mm-hmm. that's what journalists do. And that is the thing that I'm talking about, is this sort of very strategic feminism that is employed by photographers and, you know, white women journalists, where they're sort of being very strategic in how they're presenting themselves based on the context, and then getting tremendous dividends from what they get owing to that sort of opportunism. So, mm-hmm. you know, the book talks about, I mean, the paper, I mean, article talks about Muslim women, but, you know, the latest photograph, for example, Lindsay Addario had on the cover of Time, so had a South Sudanese teenager who is virtually naked and pregnant. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and when that cover of Time came out, I tweeted it with the cover of Time from an issue that talked about campus rape in the United States. Now, that issue just has, you know, essentially a drawing as the cover. Mm-hmm. So you see, again, that, you know, the kind of voyeurism that's considered okay when you're talking about South Sudanese women or Afghan women or Iraqi women is not considered okay when you're talking about American women who are survivors of campus rape.
And finish your thought. I just had another
point. That's it.
Before, we're going to pivot in just a moment because I do want to get on this other train with you for just a couple of minutes on the sort of exposure culture. But I guess the final theme that I want to hit with you on this, because I think we hit it a lot and this is really important, is the policy implications and the broader kind of understanding of this region. The other reason that this is a major problem is that, again, we seem to sort of dual track these conversations, that there's sort of like either, you know, on one hand, actually, and I think it's a little bit more emerging voice in the United States to some degree, which is like, let's, you know, don't engage and don't worry about it because that's just the way those people are, sort of like, you know, attitude, essentially. And the policy might be right of non-engagement, but the attitude is a problem. And then there's this sort of notion that, you know, going back, I mean, really to the, you know, engagement in Afghanistan under Bush, that, you know, even then, even though that was sort of like positioned on these very narrow national security grounds, but, you know, Laura Bush kind of spoke about Afghan women, that these sort of issues have always been used as an umbrella in the sort of broader policy set. And not only is that questionable in and of itself, it undermines, as an example, we've talked about, if there's, you know, indigenous feminist human rights movements in Pakistan who are dealing with religious fanatics, dealing with a corrupt and unresponsive government in many cases, and then their mission and their purpose is associated from a brand perspective with a reckless drone program, as an example, that harms and undermines the innate and indigenous work that is taking place in very difficult circumstances in all of these countries.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. I think...
Okay, Rafia, go back to what you were saying.
Yeah, I mean, I was just talking about how these overtures, they impose a cost on the society, mm-hmm. and on the women that we're talking about here. After the story from the Western perspective is over. But more than that, I think they also expose how even, you know, in this sort of post-colonial moment where many, many people are very open and eager to disavow the metaphors of colonialism, we're not critical enough of the ways in which we tell these stories. So, you know, I think that that is the crux of this issue, is that we're still telling the story with the white Westerner at the center of it. And, you know, that ultimately is what, and, you know, in terms of what you said about over there, I mean, I think the compartmentalization of the women over there, or the problems there, I mean, that, and it kind of leads into the Guardian piece on self-exposure, because it's, you know, it's when you read those stories, you see, okay, well, these are the concerns that matter, that really matter to Western women, okay? It's not necessarily, you know, Afghan women or Iraqi women. I mean, you know,
well,
like you said,
Let's get to that, because you did have this piece that came out a little while ago, and we were actually going to talk about it when it came out, but we couldn't sort of figure it out together time-wise. But basically, and I want to be really clear that, you know, this piece wasn't written because you have a problem with sort of, you know, humor or sex memoirs or anything like that, but you sort of attack this certain sort of culture of, you call it the vogue of self-respect, of the title is "The Vogue for Self-Exposure Has Reduced Feminism to Naked Navel Gazing." And it is an interesting contrast in light of the sort of crisis questions we're talking about. And you sort of go over Lena Dunham and a couple of other sort of books in that genre. Can you explain what you mean by that? I know that there are already people who, I'm sure, who are already sort of pre-offended just on title.
Well, I mean, the first thing that I think it's necessary, and this piece is, it's about these tell-all memoirs, and Amy Schumer's is out now, Lena Dunham's was out a while ago, and several others. And it kind of talks about how this very, very raw depiction of women's sexual lives that is implicated in a lot of these books. Now, at the outset, and I say this in the article as well, it's difficult to talk about this issue because, as it is, women's stories are often compartmentalized as women's stories. Women authors are compartmentalized. And in general, there's a dearth of, you know, these sorts of subjective perspectives from women. And that dearth, you know, that's been recognized over decades by many, many feminists, means that, you know, until you have those stories in the public sphere, you don't have, you know, you generally don't have an idea of how the world looks from a female perspective. So, you know, it's very important to acknowledge that, and I try really hard to do that in the piece. At the same time, there is kind of the imperative of the market, or what kinds of stories about women sell, and hence create, if not an explicit, then a de facto standard of, you know, what kind of book you can write if you're a woman who wants to write a memoir. And that's the part that troubles me, because, you know, what we have in these stories is just kind of like this this vomiting of everything about my life, you know, from like how dirty my underwear is to, you know, how I like to fart or whatever. And these are all sorts, these are examples from the books that I cite in that article. And that bothers me for the simple reason that, you know, a platform or the ability to speak and have your thoughts out there is something that has to be taken very seriously. And that's one of the things, you know, that I talk about, is that this sort of abandonment of dignity, this abandonment of seriousness, because, you know, and I question, I mean, so to what extent are these stories fulfilling the larger feminist I would say, purpose of having women's stories out there versus merely sort of, you know, appealing to a much more base kind of titillation and voyeuristic curiosity that other people may have about women, or particularly young women.
Well, can I ask you then, Rafia, is the problem then that, because, you know, I think what you said before is obviously the case. There's a market, you know, the market dictates, certainly in an American context, the market dictates pretty much everything. And you're talking, you know, about people. I mean, everybody can have their sort of different subjective opinions. I sort of like, I think Amy Schumer's pretty funny. Lena Dunham's appeal has sort of remained a mystery to me. But is it the question then that not so much though that these books are coming out and you can sort of, you know, you can like them or not like them, find them, you know, this or that, whatever, that's fine. But the fact that they are being, they're sort of, there's a larger narrative fit around them. Like there's a projection of meaning into these books and products, that there's something really weighty going on, when in reality it's like, no, it's just, you know, it's sort of, you know, all the things that you've sort of described it at, which it titillating, whatever, which isn't a problem per se, but let's not pretend that it's something greater than it is. Is that the sort of problem?
Right, because I think what a lot of these books represent is kind of the use of feminism or women's empowerment as a marketing tool. Mm. So, you know, it's like the fun and flirty feminism is what I call it, as opposed to the more serious feminism. And in a sense, it disconnects with what I'm talking about in the Nation article about Afghanistan and Iraq. At the center of it is this idea that anytime you're talking about women, sex should be somewhere near there. Mm-hmm. Because you know, I mean, who wants to read a serious book about women and, you know, empowerment? And so if you put sex in there, that's going to sell more. Mm-hmm. And of course, women should kind of like be wanting to talk about sex anyway, because that's really the definition of empowerment, mm-hmm. is women having a lot of sex. I mean, that's what Amy Schumer, at least, you know, seems to imply, and not that there is a problem for women who choose to do that, but the fact is that the repeated use of that pairing, that anytime you talk about women, you somehow have to implicate this kind of titillating attitude or titillating aspect or be talking about sex, I really worry. And you know, there's actually a huge volume of these sorts of books out, and I list them. Is that, you know, we women and feminists particularly are not really being critical enough about how sex is being employed in that equation. So it's kind of been sold to women now that, you know, women's lives, and particularly the, you know, women have sex, and that's something that they, that, you know, that that should be accepted. And I completely agree with that. But then there is this other move that says that's all that women really should be talking about if they want a best-selling book or want a wildly successful Hollywood career. Because that is something that second-wave feminists, you know, who are out of Vogue now, did talk about, this sort of kind of like, if you can't play the coquette, you're not really wanted around here. And so I worry that this new iteration, even if it uses language that is different, so Lena Dunham or Amy Schumer, you know, are talking about it in a way that's very, you know, that puts in this idea that women are themselves making these decisions, and that's totally fine. But it's, again, a very male model. So, you know, Amy Schumer is acting like, in a lot of ways, she sees this, you know, being very open about her sexual life as something that is empowering. Now, it definitely can be empowering to a woman. I don't contest that into her. But the fact is it empowering for all women? And should it be the standard by which we, you know, by which we consider whose stories are told.
So you're contesting, you're saying, just to clear, it's not that it can't be, it certainly can be, but it isn't innately empowering.
Well, you know, I don't think it's prescriptively.
Right.
So I don't think that that is something that all women. Right. And I think that they would actually agree with that.
Yeah.
You know, they would say that. But, you know, you have to add to that the sort of the existing realities of the publishing world, which, you know, the last, I think, WIDA survey was as largely dominated by white women. So, you know, what you're saying to women who may not be white or who may not agree is that, you know, I mean, that's fine if you don't agree, but by and large, those voices are not going to be sold at bookstores at the airport. It is going to be Lena Dunham. It is going to be Amy Schumer. And you know, so there is this kind of eminence that's given particular narratives versus others that may be also boring because they're not, you know, funny enough. So, I mean,
so we do dare to be boring. I mean, as a
Do we dare to be boring?
Rafia Zakaria, I don't find you boring, in spite of my sort of lack of knowledge about any gastrointestinal ailments you've had in your life. So it still works regardless. I always appreciate talking with you. There'll be links to the articles on the Majority Report website, majority.fm. Rafia Zakaria, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, everyone. We are going to go to the fun half where we will take your calls at 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. The IMs are open, and we have a lot of stories, a lot of sound to get to. So become a member of the Majority Report today, majority.fm/become a member. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. It's a great way of supporting the Majority Report. If you're using an online service like Amazon or Jet, go to Majority Report Kickback. Use our link. It helps a lot. Give the Majority Report a review on iTunes if you can. If you're not already on Two Dope Boys, hope you are. Check us out. We have a brand new show dropping tomorrow on the future of medical innovation and inequality. And several other topics we covered, including, of course, the brand F-up of the week. See you all in the fun half. Jesus, Matt.